Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Sea Control Asia Pacific, a podcast series by the Centre for International Maritime Security. I'm Natalie Sandby. Today's podcast is about geopolitics in Asia, and I have two guests, Evan Laxmana and Andrew Kwon, who are both with me at Friday's event New Voices, hosted by the Lowy Institute for International Policy in Sydney. Today, we'll be discussing rising tension in Asia and strategic competition, particularly in the maritime domain. And these were some of the themes raised at this year's New Voices. But before we plunge into that, we'll be back after this short break.
Do you like the Sea Control podcast? Sure, we all do. However, we're only a small sea in the ocean of content available to you, our dear listener, at the SimSec website. Sign up for a membership at www.cimsec.org/about/membership. China may have a 9-dash line, but our seas are clear, and we welcome your opinions and articles. Please take a moment while downloading this podcast to leave us a 5-star rating and a comment. We need them. Seriously, how do you think we pay this electric bill? Money?
Welcome back. Today, I have Evan Laxmana, a researcher at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Jakarta, and Andrew Kwon, a research assistant at the United States Study Center based at the University of Sydney. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you very much.
First, I'd like to start with a quick introduction of each of your backgrounds. Evan, would you like to start?
Sure. I'm a researcher at CSS Jakarta. I've been working on various issues in defense reform and regional security for a couple of years now. I'm also currently a PhD candidate at the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs at Syracuse University. And I'm currently a visiting fellow at the Lowy Institute for the summer.
Excellent. And Andrew?
Well, thanks again for having me. Let me just start off by saying that all my views are my own and are at risk of not trying to get fired by my boss. So I'm Andrew Kwon again, and I'm a research assistant at the Alliance 21 program at the U.S. Study Center. Previously, I worked for the Lowy Institute and was also based in Washington, D.C. at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, as well as the Center for Numeric Security. At this point in time, I think that's generally my focus has been on U.S. defense and foreign policy, as well as Northeast Asia for some of the Korean Peninsula.
Excellent. And for Sea Control Asia Pacific, we really like to bring new voices from the Asia Pacific forward. So I just wanted to ask each of you, how did you both get into security and strategic studies?
Well, for me, I think the formative event or period would have been the transition that Indonesia had in 1998 from an authoritarian rule to a democratic one. And central to all of that development in the late 1990s was the role of the military and the need for Indonesia to craft a more professional armed forces, as well as creating a more sustainable and strategic defense policy making. And I think in Indonesia at the time, there were a lot of deficiencies in the debate, and civil society groups were trying to wrestle with hardcore challenges of defense policy making. And I felt that this is the area that I would like to help more, and this is the area that I'd like to contribute more to Indonesia's defense policy making. So I've been focusing on defense policy and regional security for almost a decade now, I guess.
Andrew?
So I guess if there's a formative point for me regarding how I got involved in security stuff, I am a post 9/11 sort of guy. When it happened, I became intrigued by how exactly an event like that happened. And that sort of led me to stray away from the desired path of my parents to go into law, and look at security stuff. So I initially started with an interest in the United Nations, but that I realized as I was doing that over the course of my studies that I was more interested in the hard aspects of international relations, and that sort of set me on my way to security studies for my postgrad, and my time in Washington, D.C., working for a couple of the national security think tanks there.
Excellent. And so all three of us, for our listeners, all three of us ended up at this event called New Voices in 2015. And just for our listeners, it's a series brought to you by the Lowy Institute every year, and it offers younger scholars and practitioners a platform to provide fresh ideas on issues of international policy. And this year's event was convened by Ashley Townshend and introduced by Michael Fullerlove, and would like to thank the Lowy Institute for doing that. It's currently in its 12th year, and it's brought together a whole range of scholars and practitioners and think tankers like Evan, Andrew, and myself. So just to give a bit of background, we had three panels this year for New Voices. There was first on Japan, China, and the East China Sea. The second on ASEAN, China, and the South China Sea. And the third was on U.S.-China relations, regional order in the Western Pacific. So with those in mind, guys, you know, we were all there and we were all listening to all the panels, and there was obviously a vociferous discussion on the floor. At the end of the day, what do you think were the major themes to emerge from those panels?
I think there were a couple of key themes that emerged from the panel. And obviously, maritime security and stability was central to all of the sessions. But I think at a deeper level, the concern has to do more about the uncertainty and misperceptions about China's intentions in the region, and the potential instability that comes from either a conflict between Asia, within Asia, between regional countries and China, or between U.S. and China. So I think the centrality of U.S.-China relations and the uncertainty that comes from China's rise in the maritime domain in recent years, I think were the key themes, at least from what I can gather.
Sure. Andrew?
Again, I absolutely agree with Evan regarding the centrality of the U.S.-China relationship being sort of the constant theme that came out from all the different panels throughout the day. And, but I think particularly as someone who was observing a lot of this, I think the struggle, at least for a lot of the Australian participants, was, a difficulty finding a way to, how to respond to this, because, right now we are at a moment in time where Australia really doesn't have a sense of its direction, its place in the world at this point. So we understand the centrality and the importance, particularly of the maritime disputes, but again, it was difficult to kind of formulate for ourselves, at least at that point in time, what exactly we could do about it. And that's what came across to me anyway.
Certainly, sure. And we'll come back to that point as well. Evan, you and I both sat on the second panel, which was about the South China Sea and ASEAN in particular. I just wanted you to give just a quick overview of what you think as you see them. What are the challenges in the South China Sea?
Well, I think as it stands today, I think two key points are worth looking into further. One is the ability of either U.S. or China, as well as regional countries, to restrain the creation of new facts on the ground, so to speak, in terms of the building of new facilities or even the seizure of more parts of the South China Sea. So I think the restraint on that development, I think, is important. And the second part, I think, is the potential for escalation from various accidents or incidents at sea, either that's involving maritime patrol coast guards or whether that's involving fishermen. And I think these two areas, I think, are the most potentially dangerous development in South China Sea in recent years. And I think managing those two things should be a key priority for policymakers in the region.
I just want to revisit the second half of your point there about crisis management. I mean, there are lots of ideas floating about on that particular day. Is there anything that you think would be most effective in managing crises that might occur in future?
Well, I think with regards to crises, there's always two sides of it. One is the more operational and short-term efforts, like creating hotlines and the ability to be able to pick up the phone if something happens in terms of the regional countries themselves, as well as with partners in the Pacific Command and so forth. The second part has to do with more an institutionalized form of engagement that I think is still being discussed, but I think it's not well developed, because at the end of the day, crisis is also about a management, but also about a long-term de-escalation efforts. And I think on the second part about de-escalation, an institutionalized form of crisis management between the regional countries, I think are not well developed.
Sure. I mean, just getting back to the sort of broad structures of the panel, you spoke more about Indonesia. And I was wondering to see, I mean, just for our listeners' sake, just to clarify, of the maritime disputes that are occurring with China in the context of South China Sea, Indonesia is not a formal claimant. Is that correct, Evan?
Yes. I think the position is very clear that Indonesia is not a claimant in any of the disputes in the South China Sea, whether in the Paracels or the Spratling Islands. We do have concerns over the overlapping of the EEZs in the Natunas based on Chinese 9-dash line map or 11-dash line, depends on how you define it. But I think the position that we put forward at the UN in 2010 has been that we do not feel that the Chinese 9-dash line map is a legal statement under international law, and we have asked clarification from the Chinese. So that's our official position as we stand now.
So I'd just like to highlight a little bit more what the potential role of Indonesia could be in this context, because there've been a, you know, Indonesia itself has said in the past it wanted to take a little bit more of a leading role in negotiations in resolving the South China Sea. And also outside of the region, we've had, you know, figures like U.S. Pacific Fleet Commander Admiral Harris talk about perhaps setting up an operations center in Indonesia for the purposes of looking out towards the South China Sea. I would just like to get a sense from you, what can Indonesia's role be in the South China Sea?
There are three things, I think. One is a bit informal, which is through various diplomatic initiatives, like what Foreign Minister Ratna Tagawa did 2 years ago in Cambodia, in terms of trying to salvage the process of the Code of Conduct. One is more institutional, through ASEAN, whether it's through the ASEAN Defense Ministers Meeting or through the ASEAN Regional Forum or even the East Asia Summit, where through ASEAN, I think Indonesia can provide a certain degree of leadership to these issues. And finally, I think at a more operational command, in terms of providing a platform in which regional countries can work through like crisis management and monitoring and all that, I think that requires a lot of investment and capacity building that I think at this point Indonesia is still trying to struggle to find ways to do that. But we have been moving into that direction. Like a few years ago, we've established the Humanitarian Assistance and Disaster Relief Center through ASEAN in Jakarta. We are also trying to play a more active role in terms of search and rescue missions. So I think there's definitely that potential. But I think as far as a regional hub, so to speak, in terms of operational maritime problems, I think it still takes quite some time before we can get our head around it.
Sure. Well, it seems to me that the recurring theme is that these initiatives have done primarily through ASEAN, and maybe something we'll explore another time. But Andrew, I'd like to move to you now. I mean, Andrew, you are a participant during the day, so you had the benefit of looking at the big picture. I wanted to ask you, what was your biggest takeaway from listening to a lot of those panels?
I guess it was one of those events that thankfully allowed us to kind of see that, you know, the events on the ground haven't been static. I mean, there has been constant movement by all actors in the region to try and get the kind of the institutional stickiness, to try and de-escalate a lot of the tension in the region. The problem, however, that kept coming up was that, again, it's been an experiment, and it's been a series of experiments, I mean, and, you know, often enough, the results aren't going to be as optimistic and clear-cut as we'd like. I mean, one of the things that came up, which, you know, we have, is a sobering reality, is that hard lines are great to have, particularly between the different claimants. But if the claimants aren't picking up the phone, then what exactly is the point of them? So it's sort of building up that knowledge and understanding that, you know, they have to pick up the phone, they have to do certain things, and that's the only way that really there would be a step forward to de-escalating the tensions and actually resolving the problems is an important step. But it's a work in progress, and thankfully, at least, I came away cautiously optimistic, at least anyway, regarding the fact that, you know, everyone is keeping at it. But again, it's going to be a tough, long haul, and it is going to be, the maritime issues are going to be issues that essentially do define the security issues of our generation, at least. That was one of the things that struck me. It was a good mix of opinions, but I was hoping next time maybe a New Voices could pull it off, they could get also a Vietnamese participant. Because we had Evan, yes. Thank we had a, and then we also had a Dr. Loyal Batista from the University of Wollongong, but we didn't have a, and we had several Japanese participants as well, Chinese participants.
Just to clarify, Dr. Batista's from the Philippines, so we at least had a Philippines perspective.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly it. So it would have been interesting to see a Vietnamese opinion regarding the events as well, and I think that would have provided a little bit more, I mean, it was quite rounded, but a little bit more of an edge to it. And, I think that's the only real gripe, I guess, if that's very sure. minor gripe.
That's interesting, actually. One of the things I would have given as feedback, I would have liked to have seen, a South Korean perspective, given the Dr. Takashima issue, just looking at the maritime context, but something that didn't involve China directly. I think that would have made for an interesting discussion and see actually how those other disputes might pan out and how that affects regional order as a whole. Speaking of regional order as a whole, I wanted to just get your thoughts a little bit on the rebalance now.
Right.
A couple of weeks ago, you wrote for us on The Strategist about Ashton Carter. I think my colleague David Lang and I were arguing that a new pivot might be the case. We could expect that if Hillary Clinton became president, which is on the assumption that actually the rebalance has been lagging a little bit. And that's a perception that's been emanating out of the region. I wanted to get your thoughts. Is that a fair claim, that the rebalance hasn't really happened? And what's the evidence otherwise?
At risk of being a pariah when I go back to D.C., it's a tricky thing when you talk about the rebalance, because I think if you talk to someone, and anyone really, about the rebalance, particularly if they're a D.C. guy, there is a bit of sensitivity when you ask them whether or not they're making much of an effort. And they are. I mean, when you really look at the body of work that's been sort of churned out by the administration, at least, and also by a lot of think tank community, you can never blame them for a lack of energy and enthusiasm for touting its benefits. But again, as I kind of pointed out in that article, there has been a lack of a proverbial helmsman for quite some time. So that has caused a sort of I guess the reason why you had such a strong defense-centric tinge to the actual rebalancing on itself can also be partly blamed for the fact that the Defense Department also has the resources and the means to sort of push ahead much quicker than, say, trade, particularly as well as the State Department. So you can't help but wonder a lot of the, obviously it's going to have the wrong and sort of, not the wrong, but also the mixed messages across the Asia Pacific.
Right.
I think now that Ashgard has come in, I think you're going to have a bit more direction and at least as much direction as you can swallow in the next 2 years. And after 2016, at least, I think he'll probably be working towards building at least as much capacity as possible and trying to change the reputation as much as possible for whoever comes after.
Sure. Look, I just wanted to hammer home some of those points Andrew made. You know, being a composite podcast series, we're recording from several parts of Australia here, so there's just a little bit of background noise. So I just wanted to underscore, you said there have been a lot of mixed messages going on, going on in the past, and Ash Carter would make a good helmsman going into future. Now, I just wanted to talk a little bit about some of the interesting questions that came up during the day, and this is a question for both of you. One question that got asked was, for the alarms to go by.
Sorry, there's probably something going on.
Hey, look, it's great atmosphere. Look, it really gives a sense of crisis to what we're talking about, right?
I think, Evan, you may have said something a little bit controversial there after your demo.
Yes, they're trying to hold my talk, probably. But yeah, I think it's just the ambulance, basically.
No worries.
Oh my gosh.
No worries. Look, I just wanted to get back to, speaking of worst case scenarios, one of the audience members asked us, what would the worst case scenario in the South China Sea look like? So we've got all the escalations. In the past, we've had confrontations between China and some Southeast Asian countries. We haven't quite had the United States pulled in yet with alliances. I wanted to get a sense, Evan first, then Andrew, what does the worst case scenario look like?
Well, when I was asked that question as well yesterday, I kept thinking about it. But I think the scariest part about that question is that there is no one worst case scenario. That there are multiple worst case scenarios of potentially equally dangerous complications as far as escalation goes. I mean, the potential from a fisherman leading astray in the maritime domain and causing problems, the potential of development of the pouring of more sophisticated naval assets in terms of the regional countries from Vietnam to Malaysia to Philippines and as well as to China. I think it's a mix of a multitude of different things that I think it's hard for us to pin down one single worst case scenario. I think there are multiple, but if I would have to pick one based on recent developments in the last couple of years, I think incidents at sea that involves fishermen and all that, I think has somehow been more manageable, perhaps, than the creation of new facts on the ground in terms of the building of new facilities or even the seizure of more islands in those particular disputed waters. So if I would pick one thing that's we should focus on more, it's probably the creation of new facts on the ground that could lead to all kinds of worst case scenarios.
Okay, Andrew.
I guess, again, Evan's absolutely right. He's much more in tune with that. But for me, I guess, rather than an actual worst case scenario, I think, for me, what kind of scares me more is the catalyst for a lot of these worst case scenarios. And I think, actual casualty, whether it be civilian or military casualty, will probably be the sort of the big sort of catalyst that will cause the So whatever, I mean, there are so many different routes you can take from there, but at a time when there's such heightened nationalism and particularly a heightened tension, having a death in the midst of that, I think was going to be the big thing and a big conundrum a lot of these governments are probably going to face with. How do you kind of like step back from that, without seeming, appearing a little bit like you're weakening your position?
Yeah.
That to me is a lot of the things, at least when I was over in DC, that were the things we were really talking about. What if scenario when finally, there is a death, an accident, even an accidental one, particularly these disputed territories. How do you kind of like scale back from that? That is what we kind of, we are. So at least I am concerned about it, at least anyway.
Sure. And just, you know, for the record, when I was asked that question as well, I jumped in at the very end and took it one step further and I said, you know, if that's the case, Andrew, as you suggest, how do countries step back from the brink? What happens if they're not? What happens if they're sucked in further? What happens if alliance obligations are invoked between American allies in the region in a conflict that involves China? And from a Canberra perspective, I guess one of the questions we would be wondering is, what happens if one of those alliances isn't honored? And what does that tell us about the sense of reliability of the San Francisco system? I mean, it's not to say necessarily in each contingency because the United States doesn't react that the whole system falls apart, but certainly alliance partners are watching what happens in each instance when the United States may or may not be asked to get itself involved. So yeah, that's just the Canberra perspective there. Look, moving to the other influential figure in the region, China, there was many, many interesting comments made by participants and speakers about China, to give a bit of background about where it's coming from, and some hawkish statements, interpretations made. I just wanted to get a sense from each of you, what are your reactions to some of the comments made about China, and where do you guys sit on China?
Well, that's a really a tough one.
Oh, it's a broad question. Yep.
But at a risk of sounding a bit more flippant, but I think the problem with these more hawkish interpretations has to do more with the fact that there is a lack of clarity and a sense of opaqueness in terms of how China is run. Especially with regards to foreign policy and the defense community there in China. So I think there is this need to have to toe the party line, so to speak. And I think that's creating a problem of communication because there is an impression, at least that I've got, both from the conference as well as previous encounters with my Chinese counterparts, is that they're willing to state their position, but they're not willing to listen to our position. And there's lack of engaging dialogue and more about, here's my position, you guys live with it. And I think that's what's creating a more a resistant, I think, if you feel, from the regional countries. And I think this has to do as well with China's concerns that regional countries are ganging up on China over these issues. And this goes back to your earlier point about the alliance dynamics in the region. One of the biggest concerns that comes out of some policymakers who studied the World War, for example, is this idea of chain ganging. That the U.S. will get sucked into a conflict between Japan and China or between the Philippines and China. And I think, it may not necessarily be the worst thing in the world if that particular alliance commitment that could create some chain ganging effect is actually not fully honored. So I think that concern of Chinese of China being encircled by the alliance systems that the U.S. has, as well as from regional countries in Southeast Asia trying to gang up on China on the South China Sea, I think is probably why they would rather not have a dialogue and just state the party line and then have us live with it.
Andrew?
I guess when you're talking about the range of opinions regarding China, again, it's very much based on where a lot of these people were coming from. I mean, you had people come in, a lot of our participants also come in from DFAT and DOD, and obviously I won't name names, but again, when I saw when they were talking about China, it reflected their institutional positions quite a bit. And particularly when you had people come from the US, I do agree with the, there's been a lot of talk about how the American perspective has changed and how you're seeing how the doves and the hawks are sort of starting to converge a little bit in the center a little bit. And that's not really surprising because when you look at growing I think it's more of a source of growing frustration. Than actual sort of like, we don't trust them. A lot of times when you have an American counterpart talk to a Chinese counterpart, the person that you talk to one time may change in 6 months. So there's never been a clear sense of consistency. And Americans, I think, have taken some offense to that, and it's forced them to take a little bit of a harder line and treat them all in the same. But I agree in the sense that we do need a bit more nuance when understanding, the Chinese, policy making framework. A lot of the work, particularly by Linda Jakobsen in trying to understand with actors involved in the foreign policy making, is an important part of it. But at the same time, we have to balance that with the fact that facts are changing on the ground very quickly, often. Same. And it means there has to be a sense that particular people who are working on the front lines, particularly people in defense, are forced to make sort of split-second decisions. And sometimes they really can't take into too much consideration about the intricacies of the different domestic actors who are forcing this. So, again, I'm sort of of the mind that we need to balance the need for nuance and the need to be a bit, light on our feet. But at the same time, I kind of understand that there's a challenge given the lack of resources and capacity.
Certainly. Look, I just wanted to change gears for a little bit. I mean, there was a lot of pessimism, doom and gloom about the kinds of maritime disputes that were coming out of the bulk, I suppose, of the day's sessions. And then we changed to talking a little bit more about the constructive nature of Chinese contribution to the international system. And one of the things we talked about was the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. And that was raised on Friday, in positive terms. I'd like to get each of your reactions to the AIIB. What do you think about that as an initiative?
I think it goes without saying that in a region in Asia where economic development and infrastructure is a real problem, I think more development on the economic side of things and growing ties and engagement, I think, forms a good strategic baseline in which stability can flourish. So I think it's too pessimistic to say that this is all a political ploy to draw U.S. allies away from the U.S. and closer to China, or it's a way for China to assert hegemony. I think the key of the matter is simply the fact that regional countries do need investment in infrastructure, and having a more coherent way to going about it in a multilateral setting, I think, is a step in the right direction. But of course, there are some concerns about in terms of governance, in terms of transparency and all that. Mm-hmm. But I think this is a step in the right direction.
Sure. Thank you. Andrew?
I guess somebody raised this in a meeting a while back, that, you know, as much as it is an important initiative, it's also a reflection of, and I say this at risk to myself a little bit, that it was a reflection of the failure, at least on the American part, to sort of reform some major institutions, particularly the IMF, and particularly Chinese frustration at bodies like the World Bank. So you can't help but wonder that, you know, this is sort of a long time coming. It's not one of those situations where it just kind of popped out of the ground and no one was really seeing it coming. But it definitely did cause surprise, at least in DC, and you kind of did see it from their reaction regarding how quickly people sort of signed up on this initiative. And it does sort of raise the question that, and I imagine this is going to be a lesson learned for a lot of Americans regarding, you know, what exactly they have to do moving forward, how exactly this kind of fits in. Because a long time the Americans have asked the Chinese to sort of be a more constructive actor in the region. And so to speak, if you kind of go down to the baseline, this is an example. They are sort of trying to be wiping away.
Well, this is what they asked for, right?
Exactly. They got what they asked for. The American reaction to it, sort of a borderline petulance to it, kind of did cause a lot of what exactly are you wanting? You want them to be part of the system, but you're frustrating their efforts. Yeah. At the same time, they're doing what you've asked them to do, and you don't like that either. So, it caused a lot of mixed messages. And I think moving forward, again, there's going to be a lot of tinkering regarding the messaging, as the Chinese sort of flesh out their ideas. Again, details regarding the development bank is quite hazy at this time.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't comment any further on it because at risk, because I am not a guy involved in economics and trade. But moving forward, I think the American message may start to sharpen a little bit, particularly the allies' messages will start to sharpen a little bit as they kind of recover from this little slight slip back, if I have to say.
Certainly. And I think we also, if you want to sort of see another example of how that happened, the introduction of the rebalance also caused a recalibration of initial reactions after a while. So perhaps we'll see a similar thing with maturing opinions with the AIIB. I would just like to shine a spotlight. Speaking of Chinese initiatives, I'd like to shine a spotlight now on Australian initiatives. You know, some of the participants called for Australia to do more, diplomatically, to go to China and say, hey, China, we would like you to act more of a responsible international stakeholder, and these are the things we would like you to do. I just wanted to get both of your opinions. I'd like to start with Andrew this time. You know, given that we're not directly involved in any of these maritime disputes, is there scope for Australia to do more? And if so, what can we do?
I think that's the common misperception that we're not directly or somewhat in more. I mean, the degree with which we believe we're involved, particularly in the South China Sea dispute, is one of those things that we have to really sort of try and overcome here in Australia. You know, I one of the points that was raised by me, and I realized how important the dispute there was, when I realized how much of our refining capability and processing ability happens in that part of the world, particularly in Singapore, right in the Malacca Strait. And you know, Australia has this perception of itself that we sell our resources overseas, but a lot of the types of fuels that we use actually come in. We are more of an energy importer as well. So, getting that message across is as important, and it kind of, having that sense of urgency will help figuring out how we move forward. And that's the problem right now. We're sort of in this moment where, we're in neutral a little bit, and understandably so, because we've just come out of a period of considerable economic prosperity. We've enjoyed the status quo as it has, but now we're coming at this period where it's changing. And a lot of us are sort of, and I say a lot of us, and I generalize when regarding to Australians, is we're trying to figure out how to move forward. And that's the biggest challenge, I think. That's going to be the biggest challenge for us, at least anyway, because how exactly, as many of the other countries in the region, particularly states like South Korea, even the Philippines have been dealing with some time, is how do you balance that security relationship with that economic dependence on China? And again, our distance and our relative prosperity has allowed us to sort of push these questions very far down the line for some time, and now it's coming to the fore quite quickly. And I fear that that's going to be the question that really defines us, and we really have to sort of bite it in the butt, and as uncomfortable as it gets.
All right. And so, Evan, just as an Indonesian researcher based in the United States, now visiting fellow in Australia, I'd like to get your perspective on Australia's role in this region.
Sure. But first of all, let me say that if I make some comments about the U.S. national security community or the think community, it's just mainly out of my observation as an outsider.
Sure.
But I do think there is a huge difference in terms of how the security issues are viewed in Australia and in the U.S. I think in the U.S., it's very fast-paced. The size of the NATSEC community is obviously very large. It's very diverse. It has a lot of polarizing views. So I think it's harder to forge consensus on a lot of the key issues. But as a consequence of things being very fast-paced, it also means that there is less investment in terms of how to understand the region better, in terms of understanding the nuances of some of the common fault lines in the region, key actors are. And I think that's becoming increasingly a problem for the way the U.S. thinks, because the U.S. likes to think in very broad terms, strategic stability, how to manage a relationship with China. So if you try to be a part of shaping these big terms, but you are missing the key nuances in the region, I think that's going to cause some problems for some of the recommendations that you have. And also, I also feel like sometimes there's a lot of a black and white position among some policymakers in the U.S. as well as the think tank community. that everything is either very good or very bad, that it's either about U.S. primacy or not at all. And I think, there aren't that many people who understands the gray area in between. And I feel like that's not the case in Australia. I think in Australia, there's a lot of pragmatists. There's a lot of, people that I feel that understands the depths of the problems, and the nuances in the region. And I think this goes back to what Andrew was saying in terms of, how to understand Australia's role. I do think that, if Australia is seen, to be in high demand to play a more active role, I think it would probably be also worth considering whether or not Australia wants to do it alone, in terms of its sole role, in the region and energy diplomacy, or is it going to do it in concert with other countries in the region? And more importantly, perhaps for regional legitimacy purposes, is Australia also willing to work with ASEAN, for high-end diplomacy stuff in terms of managing a conflict? And I think these are issues that are more often debated in the region than in the U.S. I think the U.S. is still very much distracted by what's happening in the Middle East and Central Asia. And it's on. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, they also want to play big strategic stuff with U.S. and China without the proper understanding of some of the problems in the region. And I think that's quite counterproductive in the long run.
I think that's certainly a very good point you raised there about Australia deciding whether or not it's going to be going it alone or in concert or at least those things at the same time. And also your battle cry for more Asian studies scholars, I suppose, both in the United States and in Australia. Look, I think we might just move straight down to the to final messages, I think. It was a pretty intense day of discussions. And from both of your research backgrounds and observations, I just wanted to give you both an opportunity to make any final statements you'd like to impress upon the listeners.
I think for me, if I have to pick and choose what I wanted to say at the end in terms of what's next for the region, sure, there's a lot of threats and opportunities. Sure, there is still the consistent primacy of domestic politics for regional countries in terms of how they think about the outside world. But I think at the end of the day, one key aspect that has been growing a little bit, but not sufficiently pushed, is this idea of bringing military officers from regional countries more into the regional diplomatic scene. The rise of defense diplomacy is something that's uncomfortable. It's new for the region, but it's also uncomfortable for the people doing it. And I think seeing more military officers in regional diplomatic events over time in a more institutionalized way, in a more engaging way, I think would bring stability for the long run. And I think that's something that is not well developed or understood.
Andrew, what about you?
I think for me, again, this is from having observed it, I think the great benefit of having this sort of conference particularly was that we had this variety of opinions, and it did allow for at least a moment in time for some Australians particularly to kind of look at the issues from an Indonesian viewpoint, from a Philippine viewpoint, from a Chinese viewpoint, from a Japanese viewpoint. It wasn't that moment in time where we kind of like just went, okay, what are Australian interests in the region? How do we move forward from this? You kind of had this moment of empathy. And I thought that was probably the most helpful part of it. And I think moving forward, that's something that we should all strive towards a little bit. As much as our interests are important, we are one country in a region full of others from varying sizes, and it requires us to have and in moving forward, we're going to need a much more nuanced opinion. And I do encourage, if the listeners decide to do this, to sort of, if they can, at any point in their careers, sort of spend some time in some of these claimant countries and try and absorb their opinions and try and figure out how do you incorporate that into Australia's, I mean, again, from an Australian standpoint, how do you incorporate this into Australia's brand strategy and vision forward, particularly as participation in the region increases over the next decade?
Yeah. I think I'd back up both of the opinions of Evan and Andrew as well. One of the things that really impressed me was some of the statements made about China and how actually China is concerned about what's going on, that it's actually fearful of conflict rather than pursuing it. And I think sometimes we forget that when we only merely interpret its actions and then fill in our perception of what its intentions are. So yeah, with that final point about seeking further depth, I'd like to thank both Andrew and Evan for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And to all our listeners, thanks again for joining us. You can find more of our podcasts at simsec.org. Don't forget to leave us a 5-star rating on iTunes and find more of our research online at simsec.org. Thanks again.
Thank you.